This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Laughter is infectious. You know, when one person starts laughing, we all follow suit. We all laugh along. And that would seem like a very simple thing. But it turns out that researchers like Sarah Aljo know that it is much more complicated than that. Laughter creates changes in the human body that elicit certain emotions and states of mind. And those reactions can be powerful tools and foster strong relationships. Sarah Aljo is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she joins us now. Sarah, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, this hour we're talking about comedy and how it works, and a part of that, you know, we're not going to talk only academically about comedy. We'll talk about people who do this for a living. Zach Ward is owner and executive producer of DSI Comedy Theater in Carrboro. Paula Pazderka is the artistic director and school manager of the theater, and they're both with us now. Paula, Zach, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Sarah, so tell us about this. Now, we know things are funny, we laugh. Mm-hmm. Now, we can leave it at that. But it turns out that they have a powerful role in relationships, right?
Yeah, well, what's really fascinating, so I kind of came at this question from a broader perspective of I'm really interested in the idea that we know that our close social relationships and our best social relationships are actually potentially really good for health and even longevity. And so it becomes this really interesting, for an academic, it becomes a really interesting question of what are the things that make some of our best relationships? And so laughter seemed like an obvious place to start looking. And I started digging into the research a little bit and found out that actually there's almost no evidence that laughter actually leads to better relationships, even though it seems like it should. So, for example, we know that we laugh on average like 18 times a day, and most frequently that's in the context of somebody else. It's in a social interaction. Other people make us laugh. Other people, when we laugh, other people laugh with us, and our laughter elicits positive emotions in the other person. So laughter itself has all the hallmarks of being a really important tool to facilitate social relationships, but we don't know very much about it. So I've been looking into it a little bit more in my lab with my graduate students.
So what do you find? It feels a little chicken eggy to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like, well, if things are going well with us, yeah, we would certainly be laughing a lot more than if things were tense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we, on the one hand, we think that laughing with somebody else might be a good signal that that things are going well. But also, imagine a scenario in which you're spontaneously erupt into laughter with somebody else that you didn't know very well. It might actually be an opportunity for you to realize that you see the world in the same way and you think the same things are funny, and the positive emotions that are elicited in that situation can actually help to foster and strengthen a bond between the two people.
Zach, I wonder what it's like for you, and Paula, I'll ask you the same thing in a second. The idea that certainly in real social relationships, laughter is an important part of what goes on. But now when you do it professionally, this is different. I mean, you have to elicit a laugh from somebody who doesn't really care about you, Zach.
Well, let's be clear. A lot of people care about me, Frank.
I'm just going to interject there. I don't think that's true.
and I do think that 18 laughs per day is pretty low, mm-hmm, on this scale. So we'll work
just
to get
average.
That. Yeah, we'll work to get that average raised a little bit. I think that you actually go into every situation, every relationship, on the scale of how familiar are we with that person. And obviously your familiarity with a person grows over time. So I would argue that some of the shows that we perform and the opportunities we've had to make people laugh, they may be strangers, but you may be as familiar with them as you are with people that you consider friends or acquaintances. So I think that through laughter, there are people that come back and see shows again and again. They're repeat customers at the theater. And those, what we'll call super comedy fans, may be closer to us as performers than some of our longtime friends.
If they're you could call them repeat offenders, depending on how the
show
goes.
Well, not all the comedy is offensive.
Just acts.
What about that, Paula? I mean, the idea that, but to some extent, I mean, there are lots of strangers there, and they're not about making relationship. They don't have to. I mean, they can all go home and never see each other.
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of those people we don't want to be our friends, right? I was thinking at it kind of from a different perspective, and you know, maybe something that with a little deep, that we are all looking for a common bond. And I think people that come to shows, even though they may not know me personally, they want to be in a position where they see scenarios that they can relate to. And then they start to laugh. It's like, oh, I know this type of person. Oh, I've been there before. Kind of type of thing. And then not only are they laughing, but they also notice who else is laughing. And that kind of can create this bond with even people that have never met each other before, and also a bond with the performers on stage.
So, Sarah, what are you finding? I mean, what is this relationship and what role does it play in a relationship?
Well, so just really quickly, some interesting things. We've been interested in the literature in general. People have been interested in how laughter works to create relationships. So mate attraction, for example, and what people find interesting when they're going out on first dates with people. But we've actually been looking at it in the context of ongoing relationships and people who are in romantic relationships. So in my lab, we often bring couples, romantic couples into the lab. And so in this particular study, we had our couples, one of the tasks that they did was to talk about how they first met, which incidentally created a lot of laughter because as they kind of reminisced about those scenarios. And
particularly when they didn't match.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were really interested in the idea that just the simple act of the signal value of laughing at the same time as your partner may actually be an indicator that that particular relationship is going really well, independent of how much they laugh on their own. Each person laughs on their own. So we had a team of research assistants watch the interactions between people, and for each person, they marked every time every time the person started laughing and stopped laughing and started laughing and stopped laughing. So we put those data together, and we found that just during the times, how much time they spent laughing together while they were talking about how they first met was a really important predictor of their relationship satisfaction, even independent of how much each person laughed separately.
Well, that's interesting. Comedians and funny people have certainly thought about this. In addition to the two comedians we have on the program, Aziz Ansari has thought about that, and he's talked about it in a comic way when he talks about marriage.
But imagine if marriage didn't exist, and you're a guy and you ask a woman to get married. Imagine what that conversation would be like. You'd be like, hey, so you know, we've been hanging out together all the time, spend a lot of time together and everything. Yeah, yeah, I know. I want to keep doing that till you're dead. What? I want to keep hanging out with you till one of us dies. Put this ring on your finger so people know we have an arrangement. Who's that guy? It's a priest. I want you to swear to God you won't back out of this deal. What's he wheeling in? It's a cake with two tiny dolls that look like us. Eat a slice. Now beat a little bit to me. And this is really strange. Why are we doing this? Tax purposes.
Aziz Ansari talking about marriage from the comedy special Buried Alive. Now, that one, if you would show it to married couples, depending on how hard they laughed, you know, you could tell a lot about them and their relationship, I guess.
Yeah, it might be an indicator of how much they identify with that.
And the idea is to laugh together, because I know when I was in high school, girls laughed a lot when I walked in the room, but I wasn't always laughing with them, and it didn't develop into a good relationship.
Right.
That was rough for me.
I'm sorry about that. I'm really sorry. You know, I'm sure things have changed for you now. But yeah, so we.
Well, I'm no longer looking for high school girls.
There
so that's
you,
one
for
thing.
One,
we
know.
Certainly hope not.
No.
Yeah. No. We think that. Gosh, you totally made me lose my train of thought.
What we're talking about? They're talking about first of all, laughing with and not laughing at. I mean, you do have to be laughing at the same thing
exactly.
Together. Yeah.
So that's what we think is. So there are all kinds of scenarios when, you know, people try to be funny and they're not, or people laugh at other people and so forth. And so if you're sitting with somebody that you think you know and they're laughing at something that you actually think is not that funny, or maybe even, you know, you can imagine all the jokes that you find to be offensive, for example, and that gives you information potentially.
And so when you're putting together a routine, Zach and Paula, you're thinking about what you want to present, obviously having some common common ground is
absolutely
critical,
so.
Right?
We teach comedy, and one of the things that we do in teaching comedy is teaching people how to communicate more effectively. And the reality is that we don't teach people the things to say to be funny. We get them to communicate more effectively so that their sense of humor can come out. And we know that everything that is funny has a basic human truth to it. So the reason that Aziz is able to tell that routine is that there are a lot of people that are like, well, what is marriage? how does it feel? And even though they may not have thought of those same words or had that same exact scenario, they have a parallel feeling. And so the laughter is all this universal human truth that we're connected by.
Yeah, the honesty's got to be critical, right? The fact that you're exposing some truth, I'm telling you something about me here. And the laughter is the glue that says, okay, Frank, you just said something really made you vulnerable. We're with you.
And the laughter is an indicator of vulnerability. This is my perspective. This is what I think. How do you feel about that? And if you see someone kind of wince laugh on the side, you don't feel that bond. But if they're full, complete belly laughs and people are really on the edge of their seat, that's a bond and a connection.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about humor, human nature, and we're talking about it with Sarah Aljo, an assistant professor of psychology at UNC. Zach Ward is the owner and executive producer of the DSI Comedy Theater in Carrboro, and Paula Pazderka is the artistic director and school manager of that theater. Just ahead, the effect of laughter on jury deliberations. You'll hear more about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and today we're talking about comedy, laughter, and what they can tell us about human nature. Sarah Aljo is with us, an assistant professor of psychology at UNC. Zach Ward is the owner and executive producer of the DSI Comedy Theater in Carrboro. And Paula Pazderka is the artistic director and school manager of the theater. And we were talking about relationships and vulnerability just before the break. And so it suggests that you have this condition. We're all vulnerable and have things to hide. Humor is one way to sort of tell the truth about ourselves. Mm-hmm. But then if you're talking about repairing a relationship or strengthening a relationship, Sarah, anything in your research to suggest that if I can just get you to laugh together and make you sort of laugh at the same movie, it might strengthen a weak relationship?
Well, that's actually a research question that we're testing right now because, as I mentioned, there's just no data, which is really fascinating to me since laughter seems to be such an important part of our social life. It just is the little filler in so many different contexts. And so we are testing that right now, and we really do think that that there's this opportunity for openness and vulnerability. And the laughter actually has been thought to be has come from our ape ancestors, is to say it that way. So there's actually in the animal kingdom across the board, we have this open mouth play face that people and animals make when they're laughing and playing. And you can think about children as well. And some people have actually made the argument that laughter is a really good indicator that this is a safe environment to play. And that this is where, like, play fighting and among animals or the apes, for example, being play aggression actually helps to train us to deal with those kinds of scenarios. So move it to adult relationships, for example, and you can imagine the analogy to.
Well, and it's one thing to say, I mean, certainly that face, that smile that we make suggests a certain vulnerability and openness, right? Except for that face you just made.
I was trying really hard, Frank.
But it does suggest a kind of vulnerability and openness, unlike the grimace or the gritted teeth, which suggests don't get near me. Mm-hmm. But also there's a certain amount of chemistry that takes place. I mean, I used to do this thing that was an accident, but before when I started out in news and got very nervous before each newscast, I would force a smile. I don't know why I did that, but I would suddenly relax. Mm-hmm. And then I read some research that suggests that there's actually a chemical thing that happened when I made my cheeks, when I squinted like that.
Yeah, that's a great example. There actually are studies to show that they do this really clever thing where they have people put a pencil between their teeth and either have their lips not touch the pencil or try to have their lips touch. So they're either kind of grimacing in the latter case or they're smiling. And then they have them rate their emotions after they do that for a couple minutes. And indeed, people who have that the smiling face do report being in a better mood. And so there's that kind of chemistry. And the other interesting thing about laughter is that it's potentially signals to the other person. So we know that laughter elicits laughter in the people who hear it. And there's been a lot of really interesting research on eye contact and how people eye contact between people actually helps to kind of facilitate bonds as well. And so if you're laughing at something and you look to the other person to see if they think it's funny too, and you hear them laughing, and then there's kind of this joint laughter, there's another mechanism that may be happening here, which is mirror neurons. And so that might be kind of the brain-based mechanism through which if I'm laughing, you spontaneously start laughing because you through that eye contact. And then so there's a lot of chemistry that's potentially happening there. And
mirror neurons, those little brain cells that actually make us act in motor, motor responses. Things mm-hmm. happen in us as though we were doing the thing we're seeing. And that's a very cool.
Actually something that we do at the theater is that when we even have people seat in a general admission audience, we get them to sit as close as they can to each mm-hmm. other. So they're in that proximity. And so if there is a laugh, there is a moment of joy that's being experienced, that actually gets to go through a wave. And there's no dead space. They're able to look right next to them at a stranger, perhaps, and mm-hmm. see, you're laughing as well. And then that catches on. It is contagious.
Well, and performers talk about this all the time, Paula, but as long as we're talking about the chemistry of laughter, if you're a performer, you really need to feel that the audience is in a laughing mood, right? And you grow sensitive to that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I've had wonderful experiences where I felt like myself and the audience were totally bonded and on the same page. And I know that probably Zach has felt this too, is that and then other times where it's just like, we weren't communicating. We weren't on the same page.
Is there anyone in the room?
Right.
Is this thing on?
Well, then you start searching, don't you? You've got some stuff, but now if people are with you, you can go broader and broader and broader because you know you've got lots of latitude.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. When you do get that first laugh and yeah. there's that wave of laughter and it comes back to you on stage, you now, having been vulnerable, now feel confident because you're connected mm-hmm. and bonded in this way. So as a comedian, you take more risks. You actually put yourself and your ideas out there in a way that maybe you wouldn't have before. So it's really interesting to see that as a reciprocal effect.
So if that's what's happening in relationships, Sarah, then the idea of risk and vulnerability could be seen as crucial to mm-hmm. even developing a relationship. If we share our vulnerability and are open to risk, that may make us – that's the primary factor.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what we think might be going on there is that it – so when there's that moment of laughter, it's a really great opportunity to show a little bit more of yourself and, you know, be a little silly, for example, mm-hmm. and laughter promotes a little play. So then you're like, oh, this person still thinks I'm okay and right. kind of moving on and exposing yourself a little
bit more.
Are there
gender differences?
In a good way.
Are there gender differences? Well, that's the other thing. I mean, you could be covering up, too. It could just be a smokescreen to not get close to me, right?
But,
I mean, you know,
true.
That lampshade on my head is what keeps you from seeing my face, that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I'll take mine off right now.
Thank you.
Sarah, are there differences in genders in terms of who laughs at what?
I don't know that there's a lot of good data on gender differences in terms of who laughs at what. I know mostly in the romantic scenarios, we know that what people look for in terms of humor use, for example, that they're in opposite sex relationships, women appear to be interested in finding men who can make them laugh, and men seem to be interested in women who laugh at them or mm-hmm. laugh at their jokes, I should say.
There's a very distinct difference.
Yeah.
Very distinct difference.
I'm laughing at you right now.
That was so funny, Zach.
Your jokes, yeah. Not very funny. You, hilarious.
Yeah. That's so sad.
Do you find that in audiences? Do you hear, you know, sort of different timbres in the laughs depending on the joke?
It's interesting. So at DSI, we consider ourselves a comedy theater versus a comedy club. And the difference there is I believe that people go to the theater because they actually want to laugh. Mm-hmm. They've made a decision, and actually this has been the case in the last decade or so, you know, 5 to 10 years, is that people are more discerning with their entertainment dollar. And so if they do spend that money to go be entertained, the hope is that they will be entertained versus a cross my arms, have my two drink minimum, sit back, make me laugh right. if you can, mm-hmm. Which is an attitude we don't really see at DSI very much.
So people are, so your audiences are then sophisticated enough, I guess, to make that distinction going in. They don't see comedy theater, think comedy clubs, show up and say, where's my drink?
I would say for the most part, no. I think we're really lucky that the folks that come to our theater, that it's like we're in it together kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Even though they're not on stage or whatever, they're in a position where they're open to laughing and instead of like having it be a competition in essence, which is fantastic as a performer because it's such a – as Zach said, once you're able to have that first wave of laughter as a performer, you're ready to take on more risk and you can go places that you never would have imagined because you're each building each other up.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see some of the surprising places in which laughter turns out to be a very important ingredient. Interesting research out of North Carolina State University shows that in jury deliberations, laughter is actually used to reduce tension in high-stakes death penalty cases. And here to tell us more about that is Joanne Keaton. She's a communications professor at NC State. Joanne, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about your research.
Sure. We were lucky to get a transcript from a case in the state of Ohio that had been part of the ABC news in the jury room. And we were given the entire transcript after some time, and 414 pages, starting to reading both the guilt or innocence phase of the jury and then the penalty phase of the jury, and we were just struck by how many times they laughed. It just would seem if you were guilty of murdering two people and the jury was deliberating that laughter probably wouldn't come up. And we were really intrigued about the notion of laughter. As a communication scholar, we study how people talk, what messages they send, and the meanings that those messages create. And so we got involved in looking at what the laughter does in each of those situations.
And interestingly enough, that's not what you were looking for. You didn't go into this case looking for that, right?
Absolutely not. We went in looking for the arguments that they were creating for guilt or innocence, or for a particular penalty. So we were not looking for laughter at all. It really surprised us.
And of course, in the transcript, in all caps, they have the word laughter, and it keeps showing up, and you're thinking, what's that doing in this death penalty case? So what did you determine?
Well, we found that laughter works a bit differently in these kind of emergent conversations rather than in a situation where you expect laughter to occur. And so for one example, we found that laughter has relational functions, and that's very similar to what you and the other guests have been talking about. Tension released, putting a member down, kidding with someone. But in this particular jury deliberation, we also found that laughter served procedural functions. So when someone made a mistake in the procedure they were supposed to follow, or there was confusion about the procedure they were supposed to follow, because as you know, juries are given procedures and regulations and rules by the judge, and that differs for every kind of court. And so the jurors, there's no way the jurors can know what those are. So they do make procedural errors as they move through. So they would start to laugh when they get those procedural errors. They also would laugh when they would bring a topic to a closure, and that was something we didn't expect. So they would like finish a topic. It was almost like, thank goodness that's over, and people would start laughing.
Well, Zach, let me stop you right there. I want to hear the rest of it. But Zach and Paula, who are professional who do comedy for a living, are just nodding as though, of course, when you talked about bringing it to an end. Why?
Well, bring it to an end, having this finale, this emotional release. This is great. That was fun, right? and often in this case, it seems like the cases that you've been looking at are in no way fun. So in comedy, we teach two things, this process of repetition and contrast. And we find comedy in those two things. So the idea of hearing laughter at the end of what was probably very heavy content and very rigid and specific procedure feels completely natural, both from a comedic mind and also the process itself, to have that release valve.
Yeah, I was looking at it from a slightly different angle.
As she always does.
which is, you know, I always think of about laughter as not only the being surprised and laughing at something, but also the anticipation of when you're going to get to that point to be able to laugh. In comedy, we talk about patterns, contrast, and repetition. Part of it is you're already starting to be like get excited and maybe even start laughing when you know that that thing that you are waiting for is going to happen. And so you're like, oh, I can't wait. Not necessarily when you're talking about jury deliberation, but I can't wait for that thing to happen. It's going to happen. Oh, my gosh, it did happen. That's so hilarious.
And it finally is over. And so the end of any kind of procedure certainly would bring that to, you know, we knew this day would come, and here it is.
And right? Here it is.
And particularly when there's a lot of tension.
There's a natural roller coaster through any human activity. And so reaching the end of that is going to elicit that reaction.
So, Joanne, what else? So you talked about the fact that these were impasses and kind of or when there were procedural questions, people didn't know what to do at the end of any particular segment. What else did you find?
We also found that when they didn't agree on information, that they also laughed. So some people would try to hide the knowledge that existed in the room or knowledge that was given at the trial. Sometimes when people would confirm knowledge for one another, they would start to laugh. So we found that laughter really does three things. It manages the relationships among the people, even though these people don't know one another. It manages the procedures as they go through their work, and it also helps them understand the information that they're exchanging. And, of course, in any of these instances of laughter in this jury, no one was using humor.
So it's interesting. Somebody made a joke, and yet laughter was the response to one of these sort of moments that you identify.
Right.
These are liminal moments, it seems to me. These are moments at the border of something. We're all describing edges, the edge of our knowledge, what we know. So the limit between what we know and what we don't know, the limit between procedure A and procedure B, the limit between information that we all had and didn't. And it strikes me that that's really where humor works best. It's always right on the border, and it because we think we know there, and then you fall off the edge. Mm-hmm. I mean, Louis C.K., I think, is a comedian who is always just a little bit beyond the edge. And when you think about the way you can use humor to talk about taboo subjects, to talk about race, for instance. I mean, here's Louis C.K., and he's talking about how great it is to be white. Listen.
Sorry I'm being so negative. I'm a bummer. I don't know. I shouldn't be. I'm a very, lucky guy. I got a lot going for me. I'm healthy. I'm relatively young. I'm white, which thank God for boy. That is a huge leg up. Are you kidding me? Oh, God, I love being white. I really do. Seriously, if you're not white, you're missing out because this is thoroughly good. But let me be clear, by the way. I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh, yeah, I'll take white again. Absolutely. I've been enjoying that. I'm going to stick with white. Thank you. Here's how great it is to be white. I could get in a time machine and go to any time, and it would be awesome when I get there. That is exclusively a white privilege. Black people can't with time machines. A black guy in a time machine is like, hey, think before 1980. No, thank you. I don't want to go.
There you go. Louis C.K. I mean, who wants to talk about white privilege? Oh, there's no such thing as white privilege. Oh, yeah. And we're all laughing.
And you have that moment, and I'm a white male on the panel. You have that moment where you are just up to the edge knowing what is he going to say next? What is he going to say next? And the idea of this moment of transition is the reveal, right? And that's comedy. Comedy is set up, revelation, set up punchline. And so in this, you are laughing on the edge of what will he reveal next? What new line of commentary will he reveal next? And you don't think that he will say the things he will say, and then he says them all.
He says them all. And we have a common border. We all know that there's a certain truth there that we're going to have to acknowledge in his telling. So Sarah, getting back to these relationships, that's the other thing, because we're bound by convention, social and otherwise, and our lives and our desires go beyond that. And it would seem to me that humor plays a great role in allowing us to expose how we truly feel beyond the conventions and restrictions of whatever culture we happen to find ourselves in.
Well, yeah, I think it can be a really great way to kind of expose things, some of these conventions and restrictions across culture, but then also in terms of the things that we, you know, I have the relationship lens on. So it's like, yeah, the things that we think are maybe not so great about the people that we're hanging out with. And it's just a neat, nice, playful way to kind of bring everybody around and touch on a topic that we can all acknowledge and make it a little bit non-serious so that we can have a, maybe start a conversation about it.
Well, and the non-serious part is that there is a serious part of us that lives well beyond the borders. There's a serious part of our human lives that really is all about transgression, because really the rules weren't made for us. We made the rules, right? And so, I mean, the court jester has been, that's the role the jester played, right? The jester could tell the truth to the king in a way that no other courtier could. And Shakespeare makes great use of the fool in his, all the truth comes out of the mouth of the fool. So Joanne, get back to you and jury deliberations. Did it play a role in these most serious of deliberations in terms of breaking an impasse or allowing for even more clarity of thought, a third way to emerge when there was an impasse over in a polarity?
Well, that's a really good point. We found that it created a moment of ambiguity to allow the jury members to check in with one another and to figure out what to do next. So having that moment to laugh, and even if all the jury members didn't participate in the laughter, there was this pause in the serious deliberation to kind of take a check of not only oneself, but the temper of the group, and what's the group going to do next. So it was kind of a conversational control mechanism.
That's Leonard Cohen's line that I'm going to remember badly, but the crack is where the light gets in, right?
Yes.
So that's what we have that pause. Mm-hmm. Joanne Keaton, communications professor at NC State. Paula Pesderka is an artistic director and the school manager of Zach Ward's Theater. The theater is called DSI Comedy Theater in Carrboro. And Sarah Eljo is assistant professor of psychology at UNC. We are talking about comedy and laughter today, and our conversation continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned.
Staying true. Stuck on that peanut butter blue.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about comedy and what it can tell us about human nature. Sarah Eljo is with us, assistant professor of psychology at UNC. Zach Ward is the owner and executive producer of the DSI Comedy Theater in Carrboro. Paula Pesderka is the artistic director and manager of that theater. And Joanne Keaton is a communications professor at NC State. And we've been talking about sort of the nature of comedy and the nature of humans and what they have to say about each other. We talked a little bit about how comedy can help foster discussion about very difficult topics. But nowhere is comedy more evident than when it comes to politics. So we have a CNN clip of D.L. Hughley from the 2008 elections. He's going to a rally for Sarah Palin at Elon University right here in North Carolina. Let's hear it.
As I approached the venue, I could see the crowd was very diverse. White people with mustaches, and white women with visors. I learned that Palin supporters, although not the best spellers,
where's the A at?
They're doggone committed to their candidate.
What did she say to you that made you be able to connect with her in such a way?
Honestly, I just like her because she can get down on my level a little bit easier.
She gets down on your level? We are in trouble.
We need a person, a leader that's a Christian.
Didn't we just...
Country.
I know, but we just had a leader that was a Christian.
Well, we need more and more.
So we got to keep doing it?
Yes.
How many do we need before we finally go, maybe we should get the best guy? How do you think Sarah Palin sees America?
I think she sees America as Alaska.
She's a hunter.
She's a fantastic supporter of clean coal.
And she's really connected with the base well.
What is the base? How would you describe the base?
The base would be...
Would I be the base? I forgot the
question. And then there's the time when we laugh a little too much.
And that was the reveal I wasn't expecting.
Right, right. Well, and also, but up until then, I mean, there'd been a lot of laughter. There was this accumulation of jokes. And over time, it's making a kind of a greater point, although the punchline really did catch us by surprise. Didn't it, Zach? I mean, what about that, too, this sort of accumulation of smaller points that starts to point to create an actual picture?
So there is this series of questions that he's asking, and they are answering in a way that is humorous to the liberals that listen to the state of things. And then...
That's not true. We have a conservative.
A conservative what?
A conservative.
A conservative base.
but we have this... conservative listener? Just one?
We have this series of laughs in the answers, and then... When he hesitated, that was so truthful, and it was not constructed. It was spontaneous. It was in the moment, and it took everyone by surprise. And that actually, this moment of ambiguity, this moment that was talked about in the segment before of this space that got opened up in the communication back and forth for natural, true commentary to come out. And that commentary had pure comedic value. And it clearly lifted my laugh three, four times as much as the general laughter of appreciation that was happening before.
So, Joanne, did you ever have access, because it's rare to have access to jury deliberations like this. I would think it'd be pretty difficult to get a hold of. Were you able to get others, or were you able to confirm your research through any kind of similar deliberations?
There's only a handful of these jury deliberations that are available to the public and to researchers. And in the other one, there wasn't as much laughter, but given that the jury we studied was together over several days for a pretty serious trial, we can look to what we find there as being some evidence. And I just wanted to add is that they had 31 counts they had to move through. And they came to a great sense of laughter when they finally figured out that they only found the person guilty, not guilty of one of these. So it would have been guilty, 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 and they had methodically worked their way through these counts. And then when they got to the last one, it was not guilty, and there was lots of laughter. So again, much like the comedy clip that you showed us, there's a setup for it, right. And then they realize all of a sudden, wow, not guilty, and rather than making some other exclamation, the exclamation is laughter.
Yeah, and again, Zach,
it's the absurdity of the contrast. They had 30 guilty counts, yeah. Right. And then out of nowhere, nope, he's good on that one.
right.
Totally not guilty.
Right, right. Well, and so one of the things it can tell you, of course, is that we are taking this seriously, right? I mean, it's not just a checklist. We didn't get to 15 and say, okay, let's just run through this, right?
Yeah, because what's the difference?
Right, right. And so there is a – were you about to say something, Joanne?
Well, I was just going to say is that what strikes me as I read through the transcripts is you never really know where it's coming.
Hmm.
It's not like the laughter never follows a joke. So this is a very different kind of humor when it's a group of people who don't know one another and most likely don't want to be there. But still, laughter comes out. It emerges from conversation even when we have no expectation that it's going to occur. So laughter is in the group conversation. It is part of the group conversation rather than laughter that's always humor-driven.
Well, that would be interesting to think about, Sarah, from your point of view, if you're talking about relationships, because a lot of the human relationships would seem to me one partner or the other trying to amuse and please mm-hmm. the other, right? And so that's a deliberate effort to be humorous. But there's Joanne saying the laughter never followed the joke. I saw Zach wince because
I thank you so much because that's actually what we teach is that we teach we don't teach people jokes to say. We teach them how to be fun. Mm-hmm. And being fun elicits laughter. Being fun actually leads you to be funny. But if you intend to be funny, you will not be fun for very long. And so there is an approach that you need to take and know that the laughter doesn't come right. at the end of a joke. The laughter comes organically and spontaneously improvised in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say on the bids for humor, I mean, humor is one way that we can try to explicitly get people to laugh. And this is one thing that has been demonstrated. So in conflict discussions between people who are married, if a woman can make her husband laugh, they seem to have better relationships down the line. So that's, but it doesn't go the other way. But, so there's one way of where explicit laughter bids kind of can lighten the mood. But I do think that we get a lot of information just from looking at the behavior of laughter, independent of the context, the thing that caused it as an indicator of what might what the potential is for a relationship to move forward.
Well, you do lose control a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, your body loses control. I mean, any posture that any pose that you had hoped to strike that mm-hmm. made you look serious kind of falls apart when you're shaking and giggling, right? So that's part of it.
And I think it goes back to that idea of vulnerability, right? Mm-hmm. When you're all in that moment and you're all kind of, you know, everybody laughs a different way. And I think that one of the reasons that laughter begets laughter is just looking at other people and seeing it, or even just hearing it. Because mm-hmm. Everybody has a unique approach, and whether it's a guffaw or a howl or whatever, everybody's like, oh, I would never expect that to come out of you. Yeah. And so I think it goes back to it's all so intertwined.
We actually have, speaking of laughs that are a little kooky, there's actually a Skype laughter chain, if you Google this. There's this really funny series of hilarious laughs that have been kind of linked together in this video. And actually, we use that as, in some of our studies, as a way to just spontaneously, we have people who know each other come to our lab and in some of our previous studies and actually just have them listen to that because we know that it will elicit laughter and we try to create that moment for them.
It does a lot of things. It's funny because I used to teach radio theater workshops for kids, and I knew that this was going to be a lot of tension for them. They're going to have to perform in front of everybody else. Most of them were adolescents, the worst time in the world to ask a child to perform in front of their peers. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would do is sort of set up a performance that they couldn't possibly achieve any goodness from. They were going to fail. Everybody's going to fail. We're going to play it back. And we all, what did we do? We all laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed hysterically on the floor rolling. We're all laughing at each other at our mistakes. That was day one. Where do we go from there? I mean, now we trust each other. There's no place but up, right?
Mm-hmm. And we teach comedy and improv in the corporate environment. And the very first thing we do is say, what's the worst that's going to happen? You try these new ideas. You try to put yourself out there. You make yourself vulnerable. What's the worst that's going to happen? You're going to fail. And then when you fail, what happens in this safe, protected environment? People laugh. And you regroup and you move forward.
And it sounds like, Joanne, that was a lot of what's going on, too. You imagine these people brought together. They're all strangers. They come from different walks of life. They're handed this very serious mortal challenge, right? And and they have points of view and they have ideas and they can't possibly expose them to these other people. And so somehow their honest communication is going to have to leak through. This process won't finish.
Right. I mean, jury deliberation by the topic is very anxiety, you know, enhanced. But also, they sit in a very dim space. It's not attractive. It's not comfortable. The particular building and room they were in was very compressed. And so we also looked at laughter as an issue of compressed intimacy, right? It kind of, the setting that they were in kind of forced them to be together in a way that probably 12 individuals who were strangers didn't want to be in. And so we think that some of that laughter also came from that, as the laughter helped them become more comfortable physically with one another in that space. Because we noticed that they started laughing fairly soon into the first deliberation and continued throughout. When they got to the second, the penalty phase, then the laughter became less and less and less. Hmm. And then at the end of that, when they finally decided whether he was guilty or innocent, lots of laughter. So I think there's also some physical aspect to it that we really haven't addressed. I mean, there's a physical aspect to comedy, and we laugh after that. But I think there's a physical aspect of when we're uncomfortable with one another, that laughter may also be a way to help us release some of that tension as well.
Well, there is some chemistry, isn't there, Sarah, involved with laughter and endorphin uptake and all those kinds of dopamines being released and good stuff like that?
Probably. We don't
have. We don't have data on that.
We've got scientists on the spot for the data. We don't have data on that. But
I like this, Sarah. Very, very serious setup. Maybe.
It kind of worked out perfectly, didn't it? Yeah. Well, you got 6 minutes left. You can research that and come back.
I will. I'd be happy to. Yeah. But we do know physiologically the act of laughing calms our physiology, you know, our heart rate and that kind of thing. So
let me put this question first to you, Sarah, and then to you, Joanne. I mean, is there any way then to bottle this? I mean, is there some way that we can, knowing this going forward, create the environment that relieves some of the tension from these kind of serious undertakings, relationship building and jury deliberations? I'll start with you, Sarah.
Well, yeah, I think there is some really interesting research pertinent to your point about starting a day or starting a group meeting with some laughter as a way to open people up. That does suggest that before, you know, nobody wants to start with the business. If you walk into a meeting and you start with the business and just kind of go from there, then it just can be dry. But there's no opportunity. But at least you could create the opportunity for success of a meeting and more creative solutions to problems and that kind of thing if you actually start with some kind of positive induction of emotion or, you know, some kind of humor at the beginning.
Joanna's a communications professor. What did you take away?
Well, I agree with Sarah here, but I don't think that's likely to happen in jury deliberation.
Right.
It's too proceduralized for that
Fair
to happen. But I would say is that, you know, when you have these very strong emotional filled situations, that people need to feel like it's okay to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than it being the wrong thing to do, it may be the most beneficial thing to do so that some of that emotion gets out of them and gets into the group and the group deals with it at large.
I think that the real thing here is that it's okay to show emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's okay to laugh. I think now one of the things that we're finding at the comedy theater is that a lot of people come to take an improv class or a comedy class and they are sort of shut down in general in their lives. And so they're looking for an escape or they're looking for this way to break out. And it's because it's not that they don't understand comedy or they want to release this humor. They want to release whatever emotion is bottled up inside of them because of the way society wants people to just be shut off.
Right. So you're getting back to those borders again,
yeah.
That we're stuck inside these borders and there's a big piece of us that lives beyond them. And so it comes down a lot to communication. I mean, that's fundamentally, I think, what you've all said, that honest communication is perhaps a centerpiece in comedy, right?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And one of the things that we had touched on before is this idea of being playful and having emotions behind your words. What we call performing improv, we call it playing. We literally call it playing, and it's supposed to put you in this place, you know, maybe that you acted like as a child or whatever, to relax your mind and kind of connect with those creative neurons that maybe you don't always reach.
The creative neurons, the mirror neurons.
There's so many neurons.
The Frank Stacio neurons.
Outlawed in 9 states.
They're inside all of us.
Well, you know, but it is the sort of thing, when you talk about honest communication, that's one thing, and release of tension and emotion on the other. But if, again, coming back to the role of the jester, the ability to actually express what's going on with you and in a way that's, again, safe, you know. But for you as a comedian, now I'm sorry, as in a theater where, mm-hmm. again, people come in one way or another to expect to laugh, that has to be a somewhat different charge.
Well, there's a level of trust. Right. There's a level of trust that you build in an intimate relationship. There's a level of trust that we are on the same jury. There's a level of trust between an audience and a comedian on stage that we want the same thing to happen. If we're in an intimate relationship, ostensibly, we want the same thing to happen. We want to finish this jury duty. I want to make you laugh. And you came here tonight. You want to laugh. So there's a trust there. And if that trust is complete, then I can take the risk and I can tell you things and say things out loud that may not be exactly what you want to hear right now. But if you trust that we're going towards the same goal, then even if it's honest and not necessarily perfect all the time, we can laugh through it. We can laugh through some of these things that we think are maybe inadequate about our partner, but it's out there now.
Well, inadequate about us, things
yes.
that we reveal about ourselves that we had no other way of accessing or being honest
except
about. Except through humor. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Zach Ward, owner and executive producer of DSI Comedy in Carrboro. Paula Pazderka is the artistic director at that school, also the manager. Joanne Keaton, a communications professor at NC State, and Sarah Aljo, assistant professor of psychology at UNC. Thank all of you for being on the program. It was great.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
so much.
You.
For more information about any of this, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.